Welcome to Bits About Books, the home for conversations with authors of breakthrough books on sales, marketing, and business. Founders, entrepreneurs, and individual professionals, we all need to keep track of ideas that are helping create our today and tomorrow. Bits About Books will strive to find those books and speak to their authors, go behind the scenes and understand what inspired the authors to write the books that they did and how they went about doing so. Through our conversations, we hope to gain insights that will help us to get the most out of our efforts. I'm your host Shubhanjan Sarkar, founder of PitchLink, the next generation buyer-seller engagement platform, where our mission is to make buying easy. Thank you for your time and for joining us in this session. I have a favor to ask. While you continue to listen to the podcast, please leave a comment or rating at iTunes or wherever else you get your podcasts from. It means a lot to hear from you. Today, we have with us Dr. Benjamin Hardy, and we speak with him on his latest book, Personality Isn't Permanent.
When I did my PhD in organizational psychology, one of the things that I learned how to do as a scientist was learned how tests are properly developed. You know, you can't actually measure and study something without testing it. And there's a lot of rigorousness as far as what makes something a good test. And, you know, your test has to be valid, meaning that it's actually studying what it says it's studying. It has to be science-based. It has to be reliable, meaning that it gets the same score over and over and over again. And so all of my professors told me over and over again that tests like Myers and Briggs and Enneagram, these kind of popular personality tests, are really junk science. And obviously it's a $2 billion industry. And so I wanted to understand, why is this junk science, and what happens to people when they take these tests seriously? And it's really damaging. You know, I mean, it really leads people to a fixed mindset. It leads them to being limited in how they see themselves, and it ultimately leads them to a mediocre life. And so I just I wanted to explain the negative impacts of taking these tests seriously, and then just, you know, explain how personality can be shaped and developed by yourself. You know, these are a very fast food way to kind of understand who a person is, or to think you understand who a person is. You know, you get a snapshot, and personality does not predict performance. Like personality is not a good measure for hiring people.
Dr. Benjamin Hardy is an organizational psychologist and best-selling author of the book Willpower Doesn't Work. His blogs have been read by over 100 million people and are featured on Forbes, Fortune, CNBC, Cheddar, Big Thing, and many more. He's a regular contributor to INC and Psychology Today, and from 2015 to 18, he was the number one writer in the world on Medium.com. He and his wife Lauren adopted 3 children through the foster system in February 2018, and 1 month later, Lauren became pregnant with twins who were born in December of 2018. They live in Orlando. Personality Isn't Permanent debunks the pervasive myths of personality that have captured pop culture. For example, personality tests like Myers-Briggs and Enneagram are not only psychologically destructive, but are no more scientific than horoscopes. When you know the truth of personality, desired personal changes can be dramatic and directed. When you don't, personality is something you seek to discover rather than create. Now, onto this inspiring, insightful episode with Dr. Benjamin Hardy. Ben, welcome to Bits About Books. I'm super excited to have you on the show, not only because I follow your writing quite extensively and write about that, about your writing in my LinkedIn posts, but also because I think this book, which is scheduled to come out in a couple of months, is so required. And I have some thoughts which I'd possibly bounce off as we discuss the book. Do tell me, why this book? Why now?
Such a beautiful question. So the book is called Personality Isn't Permanent. And I guess why this book for me, and why now? So I'll say why for me, and then why I think for the bigger picture. I wrote this book for a few reasons. First off, I read the book, The Body Keeps the Score. Not sure if you've heard of that one. Probably the definitive book on trauma. I read that book in 2018, I think somewhere in the summer of 2018. And I learned a few things in that book that really opened my eyes. One was obviously that trauma freezes personality, which makes a lot of sense. It freezes your personality and you get stuck in the past. And then your life becomes kind of a repetitive cycle because you haven't resolved your issues. And so that was interesting. One of the other things that Bessel van der Kolk talked about in that book was that trauma shatters your imagination, your hope, and your flexibility, which is interesting, you know, and it makes sense. Again, trauma leads you to being emotionally rigid and also black and white in your thinking. You see the world a certain way and you're rigid because you're unwilling to be flexible and unwilling to deal with things, unwilling to move forward, but instead you're kind of avoiding everything. And so you're being driven by your emotions rather than moving forward in your life and being flexible to your emotions and ultimately learning how to regulate and control your emotions. And so I thought that was so interesting that trauma, and it makes a lot of sense when you really begin to think about it, that bad experiences can lead you to a certain identity, which limit your life. And so I thought that was really, really interesting. And I think that we're in a world with lots of chaoticness and lots of, you know, there's everyone's dealt with trauma. And also we live in a world with extreme addiction. And so trauma is one of the leading things that creates addiction, because addiction is really a coping mechanism for buried trauma or just for overstress, which you're not knowing how to deal with. So I think that the repercussions of this are really, really important. But also, there's one other thing that I thought was particularly interesting as far as why now. And this is a little less important. I mean, the bigger picture of trauma and obviously trauma is not the only thing. there's other things that create people's personality and keep people stuck. That's just one of them. But when I did my PhD in organizational psychology, one of the things that I learned how to do as a scientist was learned how tests are properly developed. You know, you can't actually measure and study something without testing it. And there's a lot of rigorousness as far as what makes something a good test. And, you know, your test has to be valid, meaning that it's actually studying what it says it's studying. It has to be science-based. It has to be reliable, meaning that it gets the same score over and over and over again. And so all of my professors told me over and over again that tests like Myers and Briggs and Enneagram, these kind of popular personality tests are really junk science. And obviously it's a $2 billion industry. And so I wanted to understand, why is this junk science and what happens to people when they take these tests seriously? And it's really damaging. You know, I mean, it really leads people to a fixed mindset. It leads them to being limited in how they see themselves, and it ultimately leads them to a mediocre life. And so I wanted to explain the negative impacts of taking these tests seriously and then just, you know, explain how personality can be shaped and developed by yourself.
This is very very interesting, although I have very limited knowledge about your field, but I am very familiar with the MBTI tests, and the number of organizations that still use it is huge. And you just told me the number, right? $2 billion. Why do you think people still want to rely on these kind of tests?
Because you know, in business, you have to be efficient, and inefficiency leads to laziness. And so it's, you know, these are a very fast food way to kind of understand who a person is, or to think you understand who a person is. You know, you get a snapshot of, you know, and personality does not predict performance. Like personality is not a good measure for hiring people. But anyways, people love these tests, whether it be corporations or just individuals, because these tests do give them a sense of identity. You can use the test to explain yourself. And if you don't have an identity and you can't explain yourself, then you have a hard time relating with other people. I would not recommend this as a way to developing an identity. I would rather develop my identity through mindfulness and through thinking about things and through consciously narrating my future, my past, my present. You know, like you need to define out and kind of really decide how you frame your past. You know, your identity is shaped by the stories you tell about yourself.
What I hear you say is, in a way, it's like reading your horoscope and saying that because you are born between this and this date, your personality traits will be like a Leo or whatever.
I would say that the method through which people use personality tests is very much the same way that they would use a horoscope, although personality tests feel more scientific. They feel like you're actually, you know, But really, it's the exact same thing. It's overly generalized. It also leads you to overly believing in the one identity. Like, oh, yes, I am this, and therefore this is who I always am. And that's not true. Research by Ellen Langer, who's at Harvard, and she's been studying mindfulness for over 40 years, she's found that when people overly assume a label, even if that's like I'm a Capricorn or I'm a, you know, ENTJ, you know, whatever you label, even I am an introvert, or I'm depressed. When you overly assume a label, then you become mindless to all of the times when the label is not true, which is actually a lot of times. So when you have a label, it creates tunnel vision and what we call selective attention. And so put it this way, like when you buy a car, you know, you start to see that car everywhere. Right?
Mm-hmm.
You start to see the car everywhere, but you don't see the hundreds of other cars. You don't notice those. You don't pay attention to those. And that's what labels do, is you pay attention to the label, but you don't notice the many times when the label isn't true. And so that's mindlessness. And so you ignore context and you think that the label is always true. And then the worst part is that because you've overly owned the label and you believe that that's who you really are, then you just set goals and you approach life to confirm your label rather than choosing what you would ultimately want and becoming someone better and new.
We would like to define ourselves and our need to define ourselves and finding some simple matrices through which our frameworks or lens or whatever you call it, look at it and say, this is what I am. And so thereby, this is what I can do. And that's...
Yep, it's a very limiting approach to life. It's called a fixed mindset in psychology. And it's just inaccurate. It's very inaccurate. First off, it's narrow-minded because you assume that how you describe yourself is how you always act, which actually isn't true. For example, someone who thinks that they're introverted in many cases actually act extroverted. For example, you may define yourself as an introvert, but right now you're talking to me, which is a very extroverted activity. I'm not saying you call yourself. But it leads you to assuming that you're always one way, when actually, if you had data on yourself, your behaviors would be all over the place. But you only see through your tunnel vision. So that's one problem. But also, the fact of the matter is that there's a lot of research on this now. So longitudinal research is basically the study of like one thing over a long enough period of time. And so like there's been research now where people took personality tests literally 70 years ago. And they've taken this same group of, you know, people who took the test 70 years ago, and they've now taken the test again, and they took the same measures, and these people had zero correlation to who they once were. Basically, the idea is the longer the period of time you go through life, the less you're going to be the same person you once were. Like, I'll use you an example. Like, do you feel like you're precisely the same person you were 10 years ago?
No way.
I think your readers would probably, or your listeners would probably agree. I'm not exactly the same person I was 10 years ago. Well, if that's true, and also what the researchers say is that you're not going to be the same person in the future. Your future self is also going to be just as different. The Harvard psychologist, what's his name? totally slipped my mind right now. But anyways, he has a TED talk called The Psychology of Your Future Self. And he basically talks about how your future self is going to be just as different as you are to your former self. The problem is, though, is that people overvalue their current self, and so they don't think that they're going to change as much. So actually, his name's Daniel Gilbert, but he said that human beings are works in progress that mistakenly think they're finished. And so if you overly own your current identity and overly think that your current view of reality is accurate. For example, you don't see the world the same way you did it 5 years ago.
True.
The world's changed and you've changed. You're matured. You see things differently. Your future self is going to see things differently. But if you think that the way you see the world right now is perfect and accurate and that you know exactly who you are, you're going to limit and be inflexible to what you could become.
That actually brings up a sort of associated but a bigger malice, I think, is that we with that kind of mindset are bringing up children, right?
Oh my goodness, this is so key in leadership and with children. Yeah, it's so easy to put your kids into a box and to be mindless of their growth and potential. Well, the big challenge is this. You see the world not as it is, but as you are. You see your children not as they are, but as you are. You know, you see them through your own lens. And so it can be really easy to start to view your kids a certain way. Like, for example, I have five kids, you know, right. and we adopted three of our kids, but our oldest one, you know, just as an example, he can often try to get himself out of doing work. Like, that's just maybe a habit he has. And it would be easy for me to assume that that's always the case. If I'm and sometimes my wife corrects me because I'm like, oh, Caleb, you're always trying to get out of work. And my wife will be like, Ben, that's actually not true. If you think about what he did yesterday or even this morning, he was very focused. And I'm like, you know what? You're 100% right. Like, you know, you're 100% right. You don't always do that. In fact, you've made enormous progress, and actually you're quite focused a lot of the time. And so, but without that feedback, I can just view him one way and ignore all of the things, all of the times when that's not true. And then I project onto him that view, and then he starts to see himself that way. Yes. Rather than supporting his growth and rather than helping him see that he's making huge progress, I keep forcing him to be his weakness.
So coming back to the book, how do you decide to structure it?
What a task. There probably were 50 different versions of the table of contents. Because I've written blog posts so many times and people kind of like fast information, I kind of for a long time wanted to make this book into like maybe 30 short chapters, like bite-sized bits that would pull the individual ideas together so that people could read a short chapter and just kind of have an idea. But it just wasn't really working for me that way because I wanted to have really rich and long and deep narratives and stories and really kind of pull a lot of things together. And so with my first book, Willpower Doesn't Work, I kind of actually wrote the book essentially like 20 blog posts. You know, it's just, and the ideas were not as interconnected. I mean, they were kind of connected, but the ideas kind of, you know, the ideas were individual and they somewhat fit within a framework. But honestly, to some degree, it was like 20 ideas that were patchwork together. And I wanted to actually try to really do a richer, deeper, more connective book. And so it was a lot harder. I actually ended up having a guy named Tucker Max, who's written many, many New York Times bestsellers. And it's just, he's a lot better at thinking about books than I am. He's a better writer than me. And he's a lot better at looking at. I had him help me edit this.
Okay.
He edited the book. Independent of my editor at my publisher, you know, which is Penguin Random House. I mean, I had that editor as well, but I also hired Tucker to help me beyond that. And ultimately, I just came to the conclusion that I wanted to just focus on longer chapters, you know, and, you know, bigger, you know, really complete ideas, like finished, you know, I mean, obviously none of it can ever be complete, but I wanted to give the ideas more justice and give them more time to kind of, you know, marinate the reader through longer narratives, longer stories that kind of can provide a picture, you know, rather than just trying to speed my way to the ideas. I wanted to take the ideas deeper. And so ultimately what it ended up becoming, and it ended up taking a lot longer to write because of this format, was I think like six really long chapters. So basically the first chapter ends up being all about kind of debunking the common ways of looking at personality. And it's supposed to be kind of controversial, you know, just like saying this is how most people view it and this is why it's wrong. The second chapter ends up being this long narrative about how personality really works and how identity really works and about how you can be proactive about those things. And then there's four chapters kind of breaking down the individual parts: trauma, story, subconscious, and environment. And so I just wanted it to be kind of more of a, I wouldn't say a textbook because that's not really what it is, but I just wanted it to be a thicker write, but at the same time useful. You know, I wanted it to be thick, not thin, but I also wanted it to be useful. And so that's why I went the approach I did, and it was incredibly difficult, incredibly difficult. I actually had to push the publication date back two times.
Obviously, this is a subject you know very deeply about. You have been writing about it, as you said, you have been blogging, and a lot of content that I have read in your blogs can directly sort of fit into any of these chapters or silos, whatever you call it. Did you decide on the structure and then actually went about writing it, or you already had some material which you sort of apportioned into a flow and then said, okay, this has to be a separate complete chapter because it has to make this point?
There were certain ideas and concepts that I knew had to be in there, but ultimately, basically there were a few things I knew had to be in there, and I was trying to figure out how to fit them together, but the writing didn't really start effectively until I decided the structure. And that's usually how it works,
yeah,
with a book at least, and even with articles I've found, is that the writing is so much better when you first structured it out, even just created a few of the, you know, like subheadings or whatnot, mm-hmm, and then you can free flow write or bring the ideas in that make sense. And so for me, actually, the hardest part and the thing that took about a year was getting the structure right. Once I had the structure right, then I could figure out, then I honestly was able to start pulling in the ideas that I'd been in love with, but I just didn't know. If you don't have the structure right, then you can probably fit ideas in that you're in love with, but probably shouldn't fit into the book, you know, because you can get really in love with your own ideas. Hmm. And sometimes those ideas don't actually serve the reader or don't serve the book. And so if you've got the structure right, then it can usually keep you honest and it can keep you focused on the ideas that really, really work and really matter within that structure. Because a book is just a structure. I mean,
right,
this book could have been written 1,000 different ways. And if it was, it could have had different ideas in it. But at some point, and this is probably the hardest part, you've got to decide what you're going to do. You've got to create constraints for yourself. And so, once I figured out the structure, then I could determine how to build the story or how to build the argument, however you want to look at it.
Yeah, got it.
It's time for a short break. I asked Dr. Hardy where the debate between nature versus nurture fits into his premise for the book, that you can be who you choose to be, and personality truly isn't permanent. We will hear his thoughts on this as we come back. Stay with us.
You are listening to a Business Podcast Network original. Podcasting is the fastest growing content marketing opportunity, which is untapped. We can help you craft your audio strategy and help leverage the wide reach and easy streaming capability that the smartphone penetration provides. It is easy, it is powerful, and personal. Talk to us to find out how podcasting can help you build your brand and reach out to your targets like never before. Write to us at bpn@bizcast.in. That is bpn@bizcast.in. Business Podcast Network. Podcasts end to end.
Welcome back. I asked Dr. Hardy where the notion of nature versus nurture fits into his narrative. Let's hear what he has to say on that.
Where did the argument, or did it at all, argument between nature and nurture fit into this narrative?
That was more a narrative. That was more a conversation for my last book.
Hmm.
I wanted to tackle nature versus nurture in the last book. In this book, I didn't really take too much time on that.
Okay.
Because I explaining kind of the common view of personality. A mainstream view of personality is that it's innate, it's unchangeable, it's inflexible. And so rather than banging your head against the wall, trying to be something you're not, you just got to figure out who you are and just be that. And that's kind of the common view. From a personality perspective, that's not what the science reflects at all. And the science has been proving that for over 30 or 40 years, maybe 50, since the 70s. Just as an example, there's a lot of research that talks about how your current role is a big predictor of your personality. So in one role, for example, if you're a boss, you're going to be different than in a different role, for example, as a husband or as a father. Your role or the context is far more of a predictor of who you are, how you act, than just some independent traits. That's just one aspect. You know, obviously peer group predicts personality, but other things predict personality as well. Even just how you describe yourself or your goals or your trauma. And so there's things that, you know, and the obviously the great aspect of all of this, even life experiences, obviously you go through big life experiences and it can and does change you. It changes your preferences. You know, it's a good way of looking at personality is preferences and habits. You know, we have preferences. You know, I prefer, you know, eating certain things, or I prefer doing things certain ways, and I have habits about them, you know, and they've been trained over and over and over again so that they become cycles. That's kind of a more accurate way of looking at personality. And I think that actually is how you could look at personalities. It's just your consistent way of doing things. But your preferences do change over time, especially if you're seeking growth and change. Just as an example, 5 or 6 years ago, before I had kids, I didn't have a preference to like dedicate a lot of my time to my kids. You know, even the first year we had our kids when I was a foster parent, I didn't necessarily like being with them, be honest. I was doing my PhD and these kids kind of had a lot of behavioral challenges. And I just wasn't adjusted to being a parent. Like I just, and I wanted to be their parent. If that makes sense, I wanted to want it, but I just didn't want it. I didn't prefer it. But now I do. I've invested myself in them. I've reframed my identity, and you reframe your identity by changing your narration. And I now genuinely want to be their parent. Like not only that, but I want to be a great parent, and I love spending my time with them, and I've invested that. And so like you can change your preferences over time. You can change how you view the world. You can change what matters to you. You can change how you go about doing things. And so that's I think that's a more accurate way of looking at it. And then if you become intentional about your future self, obviously, and about who you want to be, then you can become very strategic about how you live your life. In fact, what the research shows is that it's literally impossible to make meaningful decisions here and now if you don't have a future self in mind. How could you choose what to spend your time on if you don't know where you want to go?
So this is really hard, right? So why do you think people cannot get them to do the thing they think they should be doing?
I mean, it is difficult, and I'm not going to be someone who's going to say it's easy. But I will say there are things that must be done in order for successful transformation to occur. And there are things that definitely require courage. They require letting things go, letting go of even your past, letting go of how you describe yourself, letting go. And so you do have to, you know, I love the quote from Dan Sullivan. He says, all progress starts by telling the truth. I think that here's a few things that are required that I think people avoid. But if you decide you really want something, and if you start doing these things, then change does happen. So yes, it's hard. I would actually, rather than saying it's hard, I would say it's more emotional. It can be scary. It can be terrifying. It can create anxiety. It requires courage. I think rather than being hard, I think it requires courage, which maybe that's what's hard. But what needs to happen, you know, if the whole idea of all progress starts by telling the truth, and also, you know, all of the research on the idea that the number one deathbed regret is that people lacked the courage to be who they really wanted to be, and instead they lived up to the expectations of those around them, or at least their perceived expectations, you have to own what you really want. You have to admit it. You have to admit to yourself and everyone else what you want. And rather than just being who you've been and just being consistent with your former identity, you've got to actually determine and frame and define and explain who you want to be, and just say it and start to tell people about who you want to be, so that not only are you clear on what you want, but so that your story becomes clear. This really clarifies and makes your identity less complicated, because now you're just telling people who you're trying to be. And even though you're not that person yet, at least you're now working in that direction, and then your behaviors can start going in that direction, and you can start getting feedback from your environment in that direction. You know, if people don't like what you're saying, then that's feedback. It's not, you know, they're not going to encourage and support you. So, you know, they may need to be someone who you spend a little bit less time with, not because you don't love them, but because you're being fully honest about who you're striving to be, rather than maintaining the relationship and being false about yourself. Another aspect of this honestly goes back to what we talked about before, which is the fixed mindset and how that's developed. You know, a lot of us have negative experiences in life that really limit our identity. They really limit our confidence and shatter what we think we can do. And so ultimately what we end up doing is living kind of a small version of ourselves, because we're unhealed from the past and we're still holding on to things that are crippling us. And so, you know, this requires doing some deep work. 100%, you're right, deep work. You've got to actually maybe journal out your most painful experiences and how they've limited you, and maybe about how you can re-look at them, and about how you must re-look at them. You know, you probably need to either do some therapy or get some help, some coaching, where you can talk about the negative experiences you've had that have hurt you, and about how, you know, you want to resolve them or let go of them, so that you can keep moving forward towards what you want, and so that you can become more flexible, so that you're not so tied to the past.
I will dig a little bit more on this, you know, this whole notion of having New Year resolutions, right? You are looking at yourself and you're saying, these are the changes I want to make, and we will make some commitments to ourselves because we think we want to be this new person. And then typically you see that in a few weeks, the whole enthusiasm to wake up early or to go to the gym or to eat healthy sort of recedes, and you somehow go back to your original self. I'm not saying everybody, yes. Obviously.
Yeah, but it's common. I think they say about 8% of people achieve their New Year's resolutions.
Oh, really?
Sounds about right.
Must be, yeah. So why do you think that happens?
One is that their identity is still based on their past. You know, they're not telling people every day what they're going for. I mean, if someone was genuine about going to the gym every day, number one, they wouldn't try to do it alone. They'd surround themselves with friends, or they'd get an accountability partner that they would go with every day. They would have specific goals, and they'd tell people about those goals, and they'd invest money into those goals. They would begin to make their future identity their new identity, and they would begin investing money into that. They'd begin telling people about it. They'd begin creating an environment, such as peer groups or friends or accountability around that. They would also, and by doing those things, actually, because yes, it's important to note that we all have a homeostasis. We call that our subconscious. And that homeostasis is going to try very hard to pull you back to being who you are. You know, but your homeostasis is also built around your environment. And so we have an environment that's also built around keeping us where we currently are. That includes our peer groups, but also our habits and just even how we do things, you know? And so you have a subconscious and you have an environment which are tied close together that are going to really try to keep you who you are. You also have an identity narrative, a story about yourself that may just be keeping you stuck as well. If you keep telling yourself that you're a certain way, you know, that I'm not in shape, or that I love sugar and I have to go to the gym and I don't really want to do this and I wish that I didn't have to, or, you know, rather than that, you actually have to re-explain yourself. You have to re-explain yourself as the future version of yourself. That has to be your new story, that I'm going to get in shape. And this year I'm going to do this and I'm going to get really fit and I'm committed to this. And that has to continue to be your story. It can't just stop after 2 months and now you're there. It's like, no, this is now your new story. This is now your new identity. It doesn't go away. you got to keep explaining yourself, keep investing yourself. And as you make actions in that direction, you actually reshape your subconscious. And you need to reshape the environment as well, you know, such as removing the negative food, removing the things that are keeping you stuck, the relationships, the habits, or the behaviors. But as you do those things, you begin to more fully believe in your future identity. You know, every action you take towards your future self is essentially what we call deliberate practice. Deliberate practice is just like, they call it the 10,000 hour rule. You know what I mean? Yeah. But the more time you spend acting as your future self, the more that you're going to actually see it and believe it. The more you tell people about that, your actions reshape your subconscious over time. And so if you start going to the gym over time, it will become your habit. It will become your homeostasis. Eventually, you'll get to the point where you feel uncomfortable if you stop going. And so you've got to turn it into your new homeostasis. And the most powerful and easy ways to do that are, first off, to be clear on what you want. If you're not clear on what you want, it'll be difficult to measure your own behavior. So if you really clarify your future self and what that looks like, then, as an example, if they're incredibly fit and you really, you know, own that and you start telling people about that, then you'll be able to measure your own behavior. If you start eating chocolate cake, well, this is a little bit incongruent with the story you're telling, Ben. You know what I mean? Like, then, without having a clear future self, then you can't actually measure your own behavior, whether it's good or bad, because it's only good or bad based on your goal.
Right, right. Great. So if you want people to take back a few thoughts for themselves once they've read this book, what would they be?
Your goals should not come from your personality, which is how most people do it. Instead, your personality should come from your goals. Your personality should be based on the goals you genuinely want to seek, and your personality can and should and does change. And what I mean by that is that you as a person can change. You can set clear ambitions, you can define your future identity, and then you can make that your new narration, your new story, and you can then become that person. And you can do that over and over again. And this isn't about having zero foundation. It's just about the fact that you as a conscious human being can transform, and you can become who you want to be. You don't have to just be who you've always been. That's I think the core message, and that there are very powerful forces that are going to try to keep you stuck. One being negative events from your past, which can be changed and reframed. Your memory isn't an objective filing cabinet. Your memory is flexible and fluid, and you can transform your memories. You can reframe and see things differently. You don't have to see former events the same way you saw them when you were a 10-year-old or when you were a 15-year-old or whenever something happened. You can see them with new eyes, with a more mature perspective, and you can realize, wow, even though I'm not necessarily I wouldn't necessarily want to go through that again. I'm actually grateful that it did happen to me because of what I've learned and because of what it's allowing me to do as a result. As an example, I went through an enormous amount of trauma and pain in my youth, but I'm fundamentally grateful it happened because if it didn't happen, I wouldn't have the mindsets, the resilience, the perspectives to do what I'm doing now. And so your past can and should be something that's happening for you, not to you. It should be a benefit, a blessing, something you're grateful for, and something that you've let go of. You know, your former self isn't the same person you used to be, and you can have incredible empathy towards them and what they were dealing with because they were in a different context and situation than you are now. Also, you can be very forgiving and empathetic towards the other people in your life, maybe those who have hurt you, and that you can forgive them or just let it go and understand that they were dealing with what they were dealing with and you don't need to deal with that anymore because of where you're at. But you can still forgive them and let that go. So your past is flexible, your memory is flexible, your story is flexible, and your future self is really where it matters, is to really define what you truly want. And if you do that, and if you make that your new story, and if you then commit to it and make that your way of living on a daily basis so that you're living consciously, you will transform. You'll learn so much, you'll build confidence, you'll become courageous, you'll become more flexible, and your life will really open up to what's possible to you.
Bits About Books is brought to you by PitchLink, the buyer-seller engagement platform. PitchLink makes buying easy by enabling high-quality engagement between buyers and sellers through its presentation and discussion modules. Sellers create customized sales narratives using sales collaterals and personal videos and reach out to prospects through a non-intrusive, buyer-qualified engagement. PitchLink requires no installation or download and holds the entire repository of sales collaterals and buyer-seller conversations. Talk to us to know more about how you can engage with customers without intrusion. Call us on 99021-631-32.
That's a wonderful note to end this chat on. Ben, thank you so much for making time. I really appreciate. And all the very best for the book. I'm sure this will help a lot of people change their life.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
Coming up in the next episode is an eye-opening conversation with Cash Nickerson on his book, The Samurai Listener.
When I thought about listening, I did use my experience in martial arts to help me, because there were many occasions, as I realized over the years of studying martial arts, where the top people seemed to know what was going to happen next. They knew. They knew what that person was going to do. How did they know that? And they were intensely sensing that person. And so as I thought about listening and thought about martial arts, the consequences of not paying attention in martial arts, not knowing what's going to happen, is that you get hit, you get hurt. So the consequences of not listening are nothing, very little. I mean, yeah, you know, you might have missed something. Yeah, but our egos are strong enough to convince us that listening isn't all that important. I took a look at the martial arts, one, because I had an interest in it, two, because I thought this sensing really could teach us a lot about listening, and then also that why not look at something where the consequences, where people have to pay attention in a deep and profound way in order to be good at it.
We have a fantastic lineup over the next couple of weeks with great conversations with Carl Gold and Juan David Campolargo and many more.
Thank you for being with us today on Bits About Books, where we talk to authors about breakthrough books on sales, marketing, and business. We hope this conversation helped inform and motivate as we all navigate a rapidly changing business environment. For us, these are enlightening conversations enriched with knowledge and expertise. We encourage you to go out and buy the book to learn firsthand and implement some of the great ideas we discussed today. We hope to have you with us again in the next exciting episode of Bits About Books. If you liked what you heard, subscribe to the show in your favorite podcast platforms like iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever else you get your podcasts from, and give us a rating while you are at it.
This BizCast original podcast is produced for PitchLink, the next generation buyer-seller engagement platform, where the mission is to make buying easy. Hosted by Subhanjan Sarkar and produced by Rajiv Aditya. See you next time and have a wonderful day.